Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Hey, if you want to join up the chat room, it's scotthorton.org/chat. You want to follow me on Twitter, it's /ScottHortonShow. You want to sign up for the podcast feed of the interview archives or the whole show archives, it's all there at iTunes and Stitcher. All right. First guest on the show today is Matthew Ho. Formerly a Marine and then a State Department official. He made headlines, I believe, back in 2009, resigning from the State Department, complaining about the surge plan, which was certain to not work and simply be a sacrifice of soldiers and Afghan lives for nothing and that kind of thing, and has also done a lot of work on, his own and helping others with their post-traumatic stress from their times in the war zones as well. Very notable to say. He's at CIPonline.org. That's the Center for International Policy, CIPonline.org. And you can find his article archive also at MatthewHo.com and at the Huffington Post. Welcome back to the show, Matthew. How are you doing?
Good, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us on the show today. I guess I have to assume you've been watching a bit of Hagel and Dempsey this morning testifying, I believe, before the House Armed Services Committee. All right, anyway, you already know what they're saying, or I'll tell you that they're denying the CNN story that there's any kind of review of their Syria policy. But I know you've seen the CNN story that the Obama administration has decided that they can't defeat Jefferson Davis without first taking out Abraham Lincoln. I'm not sure how that makes any sense at all. And I know Abraham Lincoln has killed far more people than Bashar al-Assad has ever killed, so it's an unfair comparison. But anyway, what do you think about the discrepancy here, in the policy in Syria where, we're supposedly training up an army of 5,000 to fight every other faction on both sides of the civil war that's been raging there for 3 years?
Yeah, it's quite mind-boggling, isn't it, Scott? You read these things, or you hear these things, or you just observe them. I mean, as time, you know, goes on with this, it's like we've been living in this bizarre dream for the last 13 years, or you know, where up is down and forward is back and white is black and things just don't make any sense. And so it's hard to say anything more profound or more eloquent about what's going on in Washington DC other than these guys really have no idea what they're doing. And they're just trying to keep this, vestige of American empire. And you know, they're trying to keep the trappings of American power around the world. You know, they're caught up in the romance of being wartime presidents and senators and policymakers. And they're enabled by a military-industrial complex which we spend about $1 trillion a year on. I mean, so I think what we're seeing here, where they don't know what they're doing, is just exactly that. They don't know what they're doing.
Well, and you know, I don't know, man. I mean, part of it is, okay. I'm sure you're at least somewhat aware of the history of the Oded Yanan plan and the clean break strategy, what David Wolmser wrote about coping with crumbling states. And there are many who say that, you know, come on, all this bumbling is the plan. Even Greenwald, who's pretty, you know, center left kind of an official kind of a guy. I mean, he's great on the Bill of Rights, but he's pretty conventional in most of his politics, said, come on, this is all on purpose. Creating more chaos, more terrorists to fight indefinitely for the military-industrial complex, just as you say. You could point to, and I'm torn on this myself, Matthew, so I'm still really just trying to provoke a response out of you here with this. I mean, I can point to 1,000 bad decisions that they made in Iraq. I can talk about Sanchez and Casey and the wars that they waged and whatever there, you know, and with the best of them and their stupidity, you know, in that sense. And yet, yeah, you know, I kind of got to concede that the neocons and the Likudniks have gotten what they said they wanted, which is just unending chaos. And if it's, maybe it's not a black and white issue, but like on the map, it's solid green versus striped green on the legend there, Sunni Shia, and America is fighting on both sides of the sectarian war. And that's not even really oversimplifying it, right? It's pretty easy to identify the contradictions in the American policy. So at some point, it does. Doesn't it kind of start stretching credulity to think they're really so stupid that they still now, for 11 years straight, are fighting for Iran in Iraq, but against them everywhere else?
I think a lot of this is balanced with the notion that our domestic political understanding of the world is so black and white, is so we're good, they're bad. And I just go, you know, I go back to, Lyndon Johnson's decision to escalate the Vietnam War, you know, his deliberations over it and just coming to the realization that he had to do it for, you know, because the men on Capitol Hill would come after him if he didn't do it. If he didn't stand up to communism. And I think that's a lot of it here. I think it's just, you know, members of Congress, the guy in the Oval Office, just wanting to be tougher than the next guy. Also too, I just go also too in terms of what they think they're going to accomplish or what they want to accomplish. And I go just, I just see the neoconservatives and the whole, the folks who are involved with PNAC and then, what I saw in the government and at fairly high levels, both on the civilian side and on the military side, and actually in both administrations, was this notion that and this understanding of themselves as being on the right side of history, that they were imbued with something special, that they were better than others, and that their plan was going to work for no other reason that they were the ones who were doing it. As well then too, I think they really thought that what they were trying to accomplish was this religious pursuit of American exceptionalism. I mean, I just recall when I was in Iraq my first time in the Coalition Provisional Authority and seeing your people there talking about our occupation of Iraq, what we were doing there in such righteous terms, and then hearing as well from them, how when we're finished here, we're going to go, you know, the question is, do we go right or do we go left? Do we go to Syria or do we go to Iran? And just the lack of humility and the lack of understanding of the reality. So, I kind of keep coming back to to it that this is a plan that, that comes out of this notion that America is the indispensable nation, as Madeleine Albright said, right? And that we have a duty to liberate others and to make others in our image. That is taken pretty seriously by some policymakers. And now we're at the point when after that plan has been enacted, there's no way to get out of it without giving up the appearance of America losing her empire. And that's just where I come back. And then, of course, that's all enabled by this $1 trillion defense, you know, national security, homeland security, intelligence, development, complex that provides all the data, all the analysis, all the assessments, all the talking heads, all the guys with PhDs to make this sound like it actually can work, will work. I mean, certainly you have political generals who want to, advance their careers, so they're not going to speak out against the policy that has gone awry, that is not going to work. And the same thing on the civilian side. The civilians want to climb.
All right, so fine, but I still want their lies to at least make a little bit of sense, you know, on their face. Not on examination, of course, but just I'd like them to sound plausible at first, at least. We'll be right back with Matthew Ho in just a sec, y'all. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement, featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more. The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty, and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Before we move on, I kind of wanted to find a little bit of middle ground there where maybe instead of, a grand design that works, or just, bumbling stupidity, maybe you have, really incompetent malevolence. And they didn't want chaos. They wanted it to be easy. They thought it would be easy and they would rule everything. And what are a bunch of civilians going to do about it compared to the power of the American military? That's why they didn't really even worry about what Iraq was going to be like after the occupation. Cause whatever sock puppets we choose, we'll work it out or whatever. It'll be fine, kind of idea. And yet they just really suck at being evil, aggressive imperialists. And I think that's probably, the best description of the situation. If you think about, as you referred to there, kind of their idea of how Iraq was going to be at first. Oh yeah, we're going to have 60 bases forever. And the Iraqi people are all just going to kiss our feet and bow down before us. And we're just going to have our way there from now on. It didn't work out that way because there was Ayatollah here and suicide bomber there and they didn't get along and caused some problems. And speaking of which, this is one thing I've been meaning to ask you for a long time, Matthew, is about what you said about your experience in the rise of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq and their Badr Corps, who, Jonathan Landay said on the radio show a few weeks back, or I don't know, a couple months back now, that he was there in Kurdistan when Skiri came across the border from Iran just after the invasion. And there they were, and what was going to happen to him? George Bush put him in power. And this is in the news now because there's an Amnesty report about them torturing and killing people. And I think there was a Reuters special report about them torturing and killing people. The Badr Brigade and the Asaib al-Haq and the other Iranian-backed militias. I was wondering if you could educate us a little bit about the history of these groups and who these guys really are.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these organizations were composed of Shia exiles from Iraq that were being harbored and housed by the Iranian regime in that decades long clash between those two nations, and so certainly just like Landay said, I wasn't there in 2003 in our invasion, but certainly had a lot of friends and who were. Both the Marines and the Army as they pushed north out of Kuwait. And, multiple guys have said, yeah, they were here before we were. The Iranians were in these towns and cities before we got there, that they came across the border before we did and, made their presence known, solidified gains for themselves, entrenched themselves. And I mean, and of course they did. Why wouldn't they? But certainly, yeah, these militias, had power in Baghdad, in many ways because we gave it to them, in many ways because we gave them the money, in many ways because they had, political figures attached to these militias who, if you could kind of think of it as the difference between political wings and military wings, so say maybe the difference between like Sinn Féin and the actual Irish Republican Army in terms of the diplomats versus the trigger pullers. But certainly, yeah, I mean, our in my case, I saw us pass money to Siri. The thing I had direct witness of was writing over $20 million. In cash. It was money from the seized Iraqi assets program, the oil for food program, money that had been provided by the United Nations to CPA to administer. And then what I saw was us just transfer it just directly over to Syria. And then within Syria, as you mentioned, Scott, you had the militia, you had the Badr brigade, and you know these are very extreme, very Islamist, but also very very corrupt, very thuggish, they don't represent anything good in any part of society. So what our war there did, our occupation, our quote unquote liberation did, was allow these groups that were just as bad as Saddam Hussein's people to get back into Iran and to get positions of power very quickly, because this vacuum had occurred. And then once they were in these positions, to receive political and financial support from the United States.
Yeah. Well, now, correct me if I'm wrong. Is it the case that these guys were always avowedly separatists, that they never really wanted to try, and they have the 60% majority in the country, but they never really wanted to try to rule and conquer all these predominantly Sunni areas? They just wanted Bush to use the Army and the Marine Corps to give them Baghdad. Because I remember Muqtada al-Sadr, who was actually not an Iraqi traitor, but who stayed in Iraq the whole time, who had, you know, grassroots support at least, and he would constantly denounce Abdulaziz al-Hakim and say, hey, man, you know, we should be creating an alliance with the Sunni Arabs in the name of Iraqi nationalism against the Iranians and the Americans. What is it with you? And, of course, Skiri had the backing of the Americans and the Iranians, so they were in the catbird seat, not Sadr. But he was constantly denouncing them for basically agreeing with the Israelis. Let's split up Iraq, because that's what Iran wants.
Yeah, and he certainly saw it. And, you know, so my perspective is getting there in 2004, spring of 2004, and you now have these organizations, these Shia organizations, having taken power, having gotten control of the ministries and begin to put their own people into the security forces. And then as that starts to spread and that starts to take, as we start to, you know, again, quote unquote, give Iraq back to the Iraqi government, the Iraqi people, you now have these organizations in positions of power. So now they are now in not just in the Shia areas in the south and Baghdad, in eastern Iraq, but now they're also in western Iraq and in northern Iraq. And they're filling positions that would have, if they were locally filled, would have been filled by local Sunnis. And so now you start to see some of that exclusion. You start to see some of that disenfranchisement that, you know, is now so readily observable. And is, of course, one of the major reasons for the civil war in Iraq. Where you didn't see it occur, of course, was up in Kurdistan. Because the Kurds were at that point already semi-autonomous, and they were very, and also too, we favored the Kurds. And so we didn't push anything on the Kurds did not want. Remember, with the Sunni population, Paul Wolfowitz, who was Deputy Secretary of Defense and was primary architect of all this, and really was involved in kind of the day-to-day running from Washington, D.C. of the war, you know, his comparison, of course, was that the Sunnis were the same as the Nazis. And that led to the deba'athification program, disbanding of the army, but also to you to see it in some of the things, the way he talked about them, the way he described them, that carried down to that the Sunnis were a bad people and couldn't be trusted, and they had to be excluded from power because of their sins when they were in power, which was just complete, you know, rubbish, really. I mean, the Ba'ath Party government was horrible, but to put it on one people, is a very simplified, wrong-headed way to look at it. Mm-hmm.
Well, and apparently, Wolfowitz and them thought that Al-Qaeda terrorism was just basically a joke, a poster for them to exploit. They didn't care if bin Laden got away or not. They decided they would go and overthrow Saddam, who, you know, I saw this picture of him the other day. You usually always make fun of him because he's wearing a black beret. And I call him a secular atheist who worshipped only himself and might as well have lived in Paris. But anyway, I saw a picture of him the other day where he's wearing a fedora and an ascot and like this shiny three-piece suit and not one whisker on his chin, not one. And Paul Wolfowitz went and turned all of Sunnistan into lawless jihadistan this last decade. Man, is there any way you could stay one more segment with me here and talk about the current state of the war? Or you gotta
go? I can, of course.
Okay, great. It's Matthew Ho. Hey, all, Scott Horton here to let you know Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day, is now available at your local bookstore and Amazon.com. Grab a cold cup of coffee and follow Tacoma, Washington Detective Rick Thompson as he investigates the mystery behind the mass murder of dozens of hot young strippers and roller derby girls all across the West, while he learns new things about the world and himself. Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day. Normal, as we knew it, is a thing of the past. Find it at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Sorry, I really didn't hear the bumper music until the very last second there in that last break. I didn't mean to botch that outro that bad, but Matthew Ho was kind enough to stay on the line with us here. Where we left off, I was talking about just how obvious it was that Saddam Hussein was not a bin Ladenite in any way. The rise of all the bin Ladenites in his former territory since he was deposed because of the hubris of Paul Wolfowitz. His simplistic thinking, as Matthew described it there, of course, about, the Sunnis must go, even if that means a civil war that kills a million people and creates a generation of Al-Qaeda terrorists and the rest of this madness. But on the other hand, Paul Wolfowitz would say, hey, man, the secular fascists must go. Why is America backing secular fascists? Don't you know that's the difference between the neoconservatives and the realists? Is the realists, they don't mind blood at all. They don't care at all. They're just nation state men. But neoconservatives, we care. We want to make sure that we're doing the right thing. In fact, there's even a good anecdote. I don't know if it's true or not, but they say that Paul Wolfowitz helped convince Ronald Reagan to tell Ferdinand Marcos to beat it and end the fascist dictatorship in the Philippines and allow Corazon Aquino to come to power back in 1986 or 87 or whatever that was when I was a kid. Because he really believes in this democracy stuff, Matthew. So what about that?
You know, I think it's what's amazing is that now in 2014, shortly it'll be 2015, more than a decade after these horrible mistakes and this purposeless war was launched, these guys like Wolfowitz still cling to it. They still won't acknowledge what a colossal failure it has been. And so there may be some truth in this notion that they are believers in democracy, that they are believers in this ideology, that they are, that their purpose is a grand purpose to help liberate people. But it's absolute insanity. You're saying that a million dead Iraqis is worth the ability to go vote in a corrupt and rigged election. Because that's the reality of it. You have millions killed and wounded and the psychological harm, and now with the depleted uranium, exposure that is causing a mass amounts of birth defects and cancer rates, and so even if there was peace in Iraq, their children will be dying from their contaminated land and water. And the elections, I mean, this is the, depending upon what study you look at, whether it's from, Transparency International, blanking on the name of the institution in the United States that does it as well. But this is the one of the most corrupt governments in the world, and it's rated as a not free society. But somehow these guys like Wolfowitz, Bush just said it the other day on Face the Nation. He was interviewed by Bob Schieffer, and Bush said he had no regrets about the Iraq War because of the connections to 9/11 and Saddam's possession of chemical weapons. So they have in their head what occurred, and they have in their head that they were righteous and that they were serving some higher purpose. And I think what you get, Scott, beneath these gentlemen and ladies, what you get beneath them, or you get the cadre of loyalists. So what I would observe at levels of individuals at the National Security Council or in the CIA or State Department or over at the Pentagon, these civilian appointees who were a couple levels down from the principals, who, so they were a couple levels down from the Secretary of State or from the Secretary of Defense in terms of their position. But they were so, or on the National Security Council, they were so loyal, they would refuse to acknowledge anything that didn't fit the narrative. So in the case of, say, Iraq with the Sunni insurgency in 2005, 2006, I remember it just, you couldn't say that the Sunni insurgency had nationalist reasons, that the vast bulk of the Sunni insurgency was fighting against occupation, was fighting against, persecution, was fighting against being disenfranchised or usurped. They had to all be Al-Qaeda terrorists. You know, I mean.
Right. They were all Zarqawi. Every bombing was Zarqawi.
Exactly. And the reality was, you know, I mean, I clearly remember reading these, reading the reports, the classified reports, you know, and sitting in the State Department in 2005, reading our assessments of it. And at most 5% of the Sunni insurgency was Al-Qaeda. What were these terrible jihadi terrorists who were coming to, take our freedom? And if they didn't, make it, they were going to get 72 virgins, you know, that kind of nonsense. But you couldn't bring that up. You would go to a briefing on the insurgency and it might list 10 or 15 reasons behind the insurgency. And none of it would say resistance to occupation, because that would go against the narrative. And that would just, it was just not allowed. Just was not allowed. And so I think that's how you get individuals who have these notions, who have these beliefs in themselves and these ideas that they are somehow, they are the men who have been chosen to change history, or women to change history. But beneath them, all their advisors, all their assistants, all their workers are just these sycophants, these loyalists who won't acknowledge anything that doesn't fit what their boss's narrative is. And I think that's how you, and that occurs in the Democratic administration as well. I saw the same thing in 2009 when the Obama administration came in. They had the same type of attitude that we're going to do this. We can do it better because we're not the Republicans. We know how to do it right. And if so, in Afghanistan, if you spoke about, look, most of the insurgency, the Taliban insurgency is a Pashtun nationalist phenomenon here, and they're fighting against occupation. And it's a continuation of the civil war. It's been going on for decades. You just weren't acknowledged because that didn't fit the narrative that we have to be there to stop another 9/11. We have to be there to keep ourselves safe, to defend our freedom. So I think that's how these policies start, but then are never adjusted or stopped or halted or even acknowledged as to be going off the rails. I mean, even like you said earlier, when we first started talking about the CNN report that the White House is now revisiting the Syria strategy. And I mean, I guarantee there are people in the White House who don't believe that Syria strategy is going wrong, that they believe it's going right. It just might need a few tweaks.
Yeah. And they're vowing to make it twice as stupid. I mean, they're,
absolutely
incredible. And I see what you're saying. It's, there could be a PhD kind of course in the public choice economics of the warfare state and how this all works, where every decision is made on every basis except what the average person would think these people's job is, the national interest, the short, medium, and long-term good,
reasonable at all. Yeah, to get back to your point earlier about the need for chaos and a need for war. And I do believe that exists in Washington, D.C. And you see it in the think tanks. You see it among the defense industry. You see among some in the intelligence community and the defense community. Like I said, I haven't seen the hearings today, but the last time we had these hearings in the Senate on Syria, the graphics that were provided, the maps that were provided by the Institute for the Study of War. Not by the Department of Defense, not by the Central Intelligence Agency, not by the Department of State, but by an outside think tank that is funded completely by the defense industry.
Yeah, and which is run by the Kagans.
It's run by the Kagans.
The ones who got us into this mess. Robert, who got us into Iraq, and his brother Fred, who got us into the surge.
Yes. And so you see that as well. You see, so then you start to see, well, okay, these people who are in power, who have these notions of the righteousness of the decisions, that it's going to work out because of who we are and because of who they are, Well, now they're emboldened and they're supported by these PhDs, these academics, these think tank policy experts who are financially driven by the war. So it does. It kind of comes full circle in terms of how this works.
Yep. All right. Well, thanks very much for your time. I'm sorry. I wanted to ask even more about the current situation there, but that just leaves us open to having you back soon. So appreciate it, Matthew.
All right. Thanks, Scott.
That's Matthew Ho. He's at the Huffington Post. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com.